Pleasure to welcome you all to the second in this term series of seminars, which are held under the name of the Dean in the School of Advanced Study. Today's seminar, as you know, is to be given by Gadila Weiss-Sussex. Gadila joined IGRS as a lecturer and is now a senior lecturer, joined in 2004 from, my memory serves me right, from King's, and before that from Berlin. And en route, there was a PhD at Queen Mary University of London. So you bring a number of institutional contexts to the University of London. A number of people will know Gadila's work very well. She's a scholar of German culture and especially German modern literature. Her seminars in that area. She wrote, or jointly edited, a book a couple of years ago on German Jewish women writers, and today she's going to talk to that topic, and the topic is on the screen, Tales of the Unexpected, German Jewish Women Writers in Early 20th Century Berlin. I have a little sheet to pass around to ask you to inscribe your names on, if you would. And with no more ado, therefore, Gadila, can I invite you to give us your seminar?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much also for the opportunity to talk here. So I would like to talk to you about my research, and what I'll do is I'll give you a quick introduction into what the project is, and then I'd like to give you two case studies. And the first one is a woman writer called Else Kroner, and I'll be rather brief about her because I have published something about her, which you can reread if you're more interested. But the other is a real work in progress, and that is the writer Grete Meisel-Hess, and I'll put my emphasis on her. So, to introduce my research project briefly, I'm exploring texts by German Jewish female authors of the early 20th century, looking at how they handle two axes of discourse that are central to their identities and places in society. The discourses of Jewishness and of femininity. How do these women position themselves between conservative and avant-garde concepts of womanhood? And where do they stand in the spectrum of emphasizing or rejecting a Jewish identity? And how do they combine the two, or how do the two relate to one another? How does all that fit in with the public debates dominating the contemporary cultural life in Berlin? In terms of German Jewish culture, the period is one of continuing assimilation. It also saw a brief instance of a revaluation of Jewish culture, entitled the Jewish Renaissance, but it included too the confrontation with an ever more virulent anti-Semitism. Where gender roles are concerned, new opportunities for activities and self-definitions outside the domestic circle were available to women, especially in the new Metropolitan Society of Berlin, but these clashed with traditional gender roles. What I'm finding is fascinating and often very unexpected. The strategies of self-positioning are hardly ever straightforward. They are highly complex and often perplexing, and they demonstrate most vividly the pressures and difficulties that German Jewish women faced in a society in which the concepts of womanhood and of Jewishness were so vigorously contested. I am concentrating on lesser-known writers, not the ones who stood out for the excellence of their literary achievements, but authors who engaged more directly with the social and cultural questions of their time. And what this means in practice is that it means looking at texts that have been excluded from the canon. It means a lot of rereading, rediscovering, and in some cases, it also means modifying judgments and classifications transmitted in scholarship. And this is the case of Else Kroner. Her book, Die moderne Jüdin, The Modern Jewess, of 1913, has been the subject of scholarly interest twice before. Barbara Hahn and Sander Gilman both published articles on it in 1993. Gilman entitled his analysis of Kroner's text, The Modern Jewess as Seen by a Modern Jewess, and described the book as an attempt on the part of a self-identified Jewish woman to construct and thus rescue the image of the Jewish woman. Barbara Hahn interpreted Kroner's book in a similar way, placing it in the discourse context of a string of publications that appeared between 1890 and 1938, and which Hahn defined as reflections on the models of identity of German Jewish women, written by Jewish women who explicitly addressed a female Jewish reading public. However, placing the book into this context of the discussion of identity among Jewish women jars, as this would mean that this one publication stood in a very marked and indeed inexplicable contrast to the rest of Kroner's work. Her other writings consist of novels and psychological, sociological, and literary studies dealing with the education and development of girls and with the life choices of women, but not once mentioning, let alone discussing, her Jewish identity. Also, she published in a journal called Die Deutsche Romanzeitung, which, according to its own publicity, I quote, was striving in any possible way to nourish and support the ideals of Germanness. Viewed in that context, Hahn's and Gilman's perceptions of Kroner as a writer concerned with the self-identification of a Jewish woman needs to be challenged. We need to reconsider the author and her work. On rereading Die Moderne Jüdin closely and without any preconceptions, what is most striking is the self-distancing of the writer from her subject, the modern Jewess. This attitude of distance is consistent throughout the book and, in fact, is fundamental to it. If she uses we, it is always in the sense of we Germans. She speaks, for instance, about the influence of Jewish thought and culture on our intellectual life, unser Geistesleben. In another section, she refers to our Prussian officers and civil servants. Kroner's attitude throughout is that of an objective observer, of an ethnologist, who repeatedly stresses her scientific academic approach. It becomes quite clear that the Moderne Jüdin is not to be read as a contribution to the discourse among Jewish women debating their identity. Indeed, checking her life history, of which we do not know very much, it becomes clear that while brought up in a religious Jewish family, Kroner converted to Christianity later. It is not clear when. The record we have of this dates from 1934, but it might have been a lot earlier. But what is the book, if not a contribution to this discourse of self-identification? The answer, I think, lies in Kroner's definition of the concept of the modern Jewess. She sees her as the precursor of all that is new, the creator of the Zeitgeist, the embodiment of modernity per se. And Kroner's attitude to this modernity is, though at times ambivalent, in the last analysis, negative. At its core, then, I would argue, the book must be read as a debate of the opposition between traditional and modern concepts of the role of women, in its essence quite unrelated to any discussion of concepts of Jewish identity. Read like this, the supposed contrast between it and Kroner's other works disappears. Indeed, individual passages read like summaries or extracts from her novels. For in the center of all her publications stands the plea for a return to a traditional concept of womanhood. Over the years, her publications mirror a hardening and narrowing of her stance. Over the years, too, she can be seen to be seeking to position her ideas within the cultural currents and movements of her time and to mediate them through different channels. I see Die Moderne Jüdin as just such a positioning. More precisely, as an attempt by Kroner to illustrate her ideal of womanhood by the figure of the Jewish woman as keeper of tradition. Because of the importance accorded to motherhood in Jewish culture, this connection suggested itself, without there necessarily being an implication regarding the author herself. and in 1913, at the height of the Jewish Renaissance, a movement that sought to strengthen Jewish identity by emphasizing its historical and cultural roots, this positioning was also extremely media savvy. The wave of publications connected to the Jewish Renaissance offered itself as a vehicle for Kronas' campaign, which in itself had nothing to do with Jewish, German, or German-Jewish identity debates, but was directed to fight against, I quote, the cardinal mistake of all girls' education, namely the suppression of motherliness. After the First World War, the embedding of her cause in this context became inopportune, indeed impossible. The Jewish Renaissance had run its course. Hopes for a successful combination of Jewish and German culture had been crushed. At the same time, during the years of the Weimar Republic, the tendencies that Kronas condemns as modern were on the rise. First and foremost, the ideal of the new woman, which she regards as an egocentric barren cult of the self, and the growing acceptance of a sexuality unconnected to the will to motherhood. These developments caused Kronas to abandon her initially liberal stance on girls' education and forced her into radical opposition to the morally relaxed currents of her time. Finally, in 1935, in the sixth revised edition of her book Die Psyche der weiblichen Jugend, The Psychology of High School Girls, a book that in earlier editions had been highly praised both in the national and the international press, she roundly condemns the liberal style of girls' education and aligns herself with Nazi ideology. For example, whereas in earlier editions her ideal of girlhood was described as, or included, the female sensitivity and shyness, now her ideal is the strong, healthy, active girl. Her language also shows this involvement with the, or this alignment to the Nazi ideology. She condemns girls who tend to early sexual activity as Schädlinge, pests, parasites that have to be eradicated. She champions the heroic character of German womanhood and her völkisch and rassisch awareness. And finally, she includes quotations by Hitler and Baldur von Schirach, whereas in earlier editions she had quoted Freud. Nazi ideology and its touting of the geistige Gesundung der Frau, the return to women's spiritual or mental health, seems to have constituted in the 1930s an attractive ideological refuge for Kronas and her campaign for a traditional girls' education. Today, it is hard to understand how she found it possible to concentrate on her aims in the area of girls' education and to distance herself from her Jewish descent to the extent that she put herself into the service of a regime and an ideology which defined itself, among other things, by its open anti-Semitism. In the light of historical research, however, which has repeatedly highlighted the distance displayed by the converted Jewish population to the culture of their ancestors, it seems that this is not a unique case. Kronas' attitude may be described as the illusory hope to have left behind with her conversion to Christianity any connectedness to a Jewish identity, not only in her own consciousness, but also in the perception of her by non-Jewish Germans. In 1930, Theodor Lessing described this attitude with great cynicism as one of the three so-called ways out of the dilemma of Jewish self-hatred. And with hindsight, his analysis is especially moving. The great change is successful, he writes. The mimicry succeeds. You are becoming one of them, and you seem fantastically genuine. Perhaps a little too German to be entirely German. But anyhow, now you're safe. Really? Your corpse is safe. You are dead. You have died with your conflict. So to come back to the questions of femininity and Jewishness which guide my research, we have at Kronas a woman who distanced herself as far as possible from any Jewish identity. and who used the discourse of the identity debate among Jewish women for quite a different end, and that is to promote her campaign for a traditional concept of femininity and a model of girls' education centered on their future role as mothers. Another case in which the relationship between the discourses of femininity and Jewishness is at the heart of the process of self-positioning is that of Grete Meisel-Hess. In many ways, she was the complete opposite to Kroner. She held a radical avant-garde view of femininity, at times well beyond the pale of bourgeois acceptability. And also in contrast to Kroner, Meisel-Hess professed her Jewishness and discussed it in her journalistic writing. But as we shall see, her strategy of combining the two strands or constituents of identity is no less complicated or astonishing than Kroner's. Meisel-Hess was born in Prague, a year later than Kroner in 1879, into a Jewish middle-class family. She moved to Vienna as a child and later studied philosophy, sociology, and biology at the University of Vienna. In 1902, she published her first novel, Fanny Roth, and this novel caused quite a stir because of its open discussion of female sexuality and its call for women's rights to a fulfilled sexuality as well as intellectual independence. This, as well as her second novel, Die Stimme, The Voice, is very Nietzschean in thought and style. She uses hyperbolic hymnic language, and the stress on individuation is explicitly derived from Nietzsche's thoughts. There's a wonderful scene where at the height of happiness, the protagonist is given a copy of Was spake Zarathustra. And that sort of, you know, makes everything even better. So she also published non-fictional writing and shows herself to be a very pugnacious, self-confident, very astute writer. Her book Weiberhass und Weiberverachtung is an analysis and repudiation of Otto Weininger's misogynist writings. And in 1909, she published Die sexuelle Krise, a critique of contemporary sexual morality. By then, she had married and moved to Berlin. And then, 2 years later, in 1911, she published her novel Die Intellektuellen, which, within the discipline of German studies, has received no critical attention to date. But that's the novel I want to concentrate on today. In Die Intellektuellen, Meisel-Hess configures the early 20th century as a time of transition. The intellectuals of the title are the potential motors of this transition. They are those who have left outdated tradition behind and are searching for a higher stage of development, an enhanced mankind or an enhanced humanity, gesteigertes Menschentum. The novel discusses ways in which this development can be achieved. It includes debates on social and ethical issues, on the role and future of women, and on the position of the Jewish intellectual. Meisel-Hess guides the reader through this panorama of modernity by focusing on the lives of the Jewish siblings Stanislaus and Olga Diamant, who have moved from their provincial hometown, I quote, in the east of Austria Silesia, to Berlin. On its publication, various reviews compared Die Intellektuellen to Goethe's Wilhelm Meister. It too tells the story of individuation within a rich and panoramic social setting, which of course is paradigmatic for this most German of all novel genres, the genre of the Bildungsroman. Friedrich Alafberg, a critic, summarized in the journal Das Literarische Echo, an outstanding personality embodies the destiny of her time, but she surpasses it, shows the way to the future, and takes on a guiding role in the development of her epoch. This outstanding personality he refers to is Olga Diamant, a pathbreaker for those who will come, for those women who, with their will guided by instinct, demand to be full, whole human beings, who are no longer satisfied living within the limitations of propagation, but who cannot bear either to be excluded from the magic circle of the species. This keyword of the full whole human beings, indeed of wholeness, echoes the philosophy of Nietzsche again, who had so strongly influenced Meisel Hess's earlier work. But it goes back further to the traditions of the Enlightenment thought, and specifically to Goethe. Nietzsche himself acknowledged this tradition, writing about Goethe, "What he wanted was totality. He fought against the separation of reason, sensuality, feeling, and will. He disciplined himself towards a wholeness, Ganzheit. He created himself." Wholeness, then, is the combination of reason and sensuality, feeling and will. And this definition is recognizable in Meisel Hess's expression, their will guided by instinct. And it is here specifically used to describe the role of the woman, which is not to be reduced to the biologically determined definition of femininity, but centrally and essentially includes it. Where Hedwig Dohm, one of the most prominent feminists of the turn of the century and mother of Thomas Mann's wife, Katja, where Hedwig Dohm in 1902 still rejected the existence of a drive to motherhood for fear of seeing women reduced to their biological function, motherhood is now central to Meisel Hess's thinking, as long as it is intertwined with women's individuation. I quote, "Olga realized that a society was needed that was concerned with motherhood above all else. The problem that needed solving was to combine the necessary protection of the woman, especially the mother, with her equally necessary freedom and self-determination." It is clear that even if Olga can be seen as the alter ego of her author, this is more than a personal attempt at female self-positioning. Meisel Hess postulates ideas for social change, not in an individualist framework, but with a view to society as a whole. The ideas formulated in her novel are largely those of a radical wing of the women's movement, the League for the Protection of Mothers, der Bund für Mutterschutz. Meisel Hess was a founding member of the League and the main propagator of its ideas in the contemporary press. She vigorously campaigned for the improvement of sexual relations between men and women, and combined with this a wholesale attack on the traditional sexual morality, which she presented as not only obsolete, but actively harmful. In her own words, she fought for the abolishment of harmful customs of reproduction and the sound establishment of the rights that ensure a healthy selection. Sexuality, she argued, should be freed from the context of Christian morality and placed instead in that of a Darwinian evolutionary theory and eugenic efforts. In an article in the Journal der Demokrat, published in the same year as Die Intellektuellen in 1911, Meisel Hess declared the planned breeding of valuable life material to be the foremost concern of her generation. And this being so, she argues, the delay on starting a family that is imposed by society's conventions on middle-class men in particular is entirely counterproductive. By the time they've established a position in society that is financially secure enough to start a family, they are, I quote, old and grey and feeble. And their most valuable genetic material has withered or died or has been wasted on prostitutes. How could this be changed? Several options were proposed by the League for the Protection of Mothers, but in her novel, Meisel Hess supports one before all others: reproduction outside, i.e. before, marriage. The socially and economically independent woman, Meisel Hess points out, has the sexual selection in her hand. And this alone, she continues, is the focus of the entire women's movement. She thus combines feminism with eugenics, and by this combination, by arguing that the individuation and liberation of women stands in the service of one of the social obsessions of her time, the desire to create an enhanced mankind, she legitimizes it. It's worth remembering that the eugenic movement was, in the early years of the 20th century, not the sinister ideology of the radical right, as which we tend to think about it in hindsight. Rather, it was a concern shared by a wide range of social movements. Their concern for the improvement of the population's genetic material was based on an alarming reduction in the birth rate and on the spread of what were then deemed to be hereditary illnesses, such as syphilis, tuberculosis, and alcoholism. All the different groupings that shared this concern based their thinking on Darwin's theory of evolution, and yet they differed greatly among themselves. Firstly, because their interpretations of Darwin diverged, and secondly, because they translated their eugenic endeavors into contrasting and at times even opposing social policies. So, rather simplified, there were two main branches. One branch was that of the social Darwinists. Alexander Tiller and Alfred Plötz were big figures in this movement, and they argued for the selection of the best genetic material and rejected any protection of the weak as hindering evolution. This direction is incompatible with feminism. As their main aim was to increase the birth rate, women were seen as instruments of their policies, and their interests in individuation were disregarded. But in contrast to this, the other branch of eugenicists, the reformist wing of the movement, was compatible with socialist as well as with feminist demands. They did not reduce their interpretation of Darwin's theories to a simple and anti-humanist ideology of the survival of the fittest, but complemented the biological arguments by demands for a change of social policies. And this is the concept of eugenics embraced by the League for the Protection of Mothers. Around this, interestingly, there's a debate between Meisel Hess and Hedwig Dohm. It was sort of in published open letters in newspapers, in which Dohm says that even if women were free to choose their sexual partners, they would not choose them for reasons of the best possible conditions for reproduction. Love is blind, she argues. It's not a matter of finding the best breeding opportunity. Meisel Hess concedes this, but stresses that, firstly, if women could be active and independent of economic and moral constraints in their choice of partners, this would widen their field significantly. And secondly, she makes sure to keep the biological drive to motherhood separate from ideas of romantic love and marriage. In Die Intellektuellen, both points are perfectly illustrated in the character of Lore Wigolski, Stanislaus Diamant's future wife. Lore is a highly educated and independent modern young woman who cannot find a partner who is her equal and who accepts her as an equal. Acting on her longing for a child, Lore has responded to nature's warning call, rather than wait until her biological strength has weakened, bis die besten biologischen Kräfte verbraucht sind. She has thus done the right thing for society as a whole, even if this meant acting against this very same society's rules and morality. Rather than passively submitting herself to the traditions of social expectations and wait for Mr. Right, she has actively and independently decided in favor of an illegitimate child. Her work as a secretary has allowed her to raise her daughter by herself, and when she finally marries Stanislaus, this is not out of economic necessity, but because she finds in him an equal partner and soulmate. This combination of radical feminism and eugenic thought is unusual. The idealization of single mothers can be found in a number of other novels of the period, in Clara Fiebig's Es lebe die Kunst, for instance, in Franziska von Reventlow's Ellen oder Sterne, or in Gabriele Reuter's Tränenhaus. But in those instances, the theme of the single mother is usually connected with social criticism. It's usually about the woman being ostracized by a society, society of double standards. And it's, yeah, it criticizes those double standards. And the other thing that is always very important in these other novels is the wish for a child is always seen as part of the woman's individuation and path to personal fulfillment. Maisel Hess's depiction of single motherhood in Die Intellektuellen includes both of these aspects, but for her, single motherhood is a model for social improvement, a way to overcome a morality that hinders evolution. Illegitimate children, she claims, are often the best biological material. And following on from this, she goes one step further and proclaims die Stiefehe, the stepfamily, as the ideal. I quote, "The true elite among illegitimate children and among all children are those raised in a stepfather family." The reason for this claim is explained by a minor character in the novel. "Dear Frau Lore," he explains, "just think what a splendid woman she must be who, even though according to our society's skewed ideas of morality, she is a fallen woman, is still being loved and married." This train of thought was clearly very important to Maisel Hess. It appears again in a short story of hers entitled Skizze, Sketch. And indeed, it weaves together her main concerns, the best genetic material for the child, the moral and economic independence of the mother, and a man, the stepfather, who, as it were, endorses these values through his love and offer of marriage. Clearly, this combination provides the best conditions for bringing up the next generation, the enhanced mankind. Given this, and given the emphasis accorded by Maisel Hess to motherhood, it is striking that her main protagonist, Olga Diamant, the voice of the author's social and political convictions, the outstanding personality, the leading figure referred to in the review I quoted earlier, that she remains childless. Might this indicate that Maisel Hess discovered, after all, a problem of incompatibility between her eugenic aims and women's striving towards individuation? This explanation suggests itself if we follow Nietzsche scholar Barbara Helm's verdict. In Helm's opinion, the proposals of the radical feminists who had attempted simultaneously to appropriate the two Nietzschean tenets of individualism and maternalism were not convincing. "The women's movement failed to resolve the tension between the two," she claims. Well, perhaps, but in view of Maisel Hess's convictions and rhetorical verve, it is rather unlikely that she meant to convey such doubts in her novel. I am wondering instead if Olga's childlessness may not have something to do with the fact that she is Jewish. This may not immediately make sense, given that the author herself is Jewish, and yet. To explain what I mean, we'll have to take a little detour and look at Olga's brother, Stanislaus. Stanislaus does not father any children either. On the contrary, he lives a deliberately and at times painfully celibate life. Why? The recognition dictated to him by reason and his conscience told him with merciless clarity that he had to withhold from contributing to the propagation of the eternal substance of life. He was not to beget a human being who would be carrying the burden of his own loaded corporeality. He was strict and inexorable on this point. And what exactly is the burden of his own loaded corporeality? Well, here's a description of Stanislaus early in the novel. With his bad, hunched posture and his broad, rounded back, he appeared to be narrow-chested. The legs seemed too weak for the massive body. The big head hung down towards the chest. Further, we are told that he had bluish black hair, that his ears had bat-like incisions, that his head sat on too short a neck, and, I quote, "his narrow nose extended downwards towards his mouth, which, with the lips pressed together, formed a thin, straight line." Stanislaus carries the racial stereotypes of the Jew, more precisely the Eastern Jew, and it is those characteristics that must not be passed on to future generations, in the view of the character and in the view of the author. So, do we have another case like that of Else Kronas here? Another case of a woman of Jewish descent who did not identify herself with her heritage and in fact did everything to dissociate herself from it? No. As I said at the beginning, Meisel has accepted and professed her Jewish identity. In a series of articles in the journal Der Weg, published in the same year as Die Intellektuellen, she explains her attitude in some detail. While embracing her Jewish identity, she warns against the ghettoization of German Jews, a danger she sees inherent in any form of special treatment or separation of Jewish from non-Jewish Germans, be this in a negative or in a positive sense. And in this context, she condemns the Jewish Renaissance movement, for instance. Meisel Hess advocates a view of German Jews as fully integrated members in what she calls the flow of cosmopolitan culture. This cosmopolitan or true culture cannot be attained through perpetuating the separation of the many various cultures practiced across the population as a whole, be they racially, religiously, regionally, or in any other way defined. All different cultures, creeds, and races have to be overcome to reach improvement through variation and assimilation, entirely according to the tenets of the theory of evolution. A comparison with Walter Rathenau is interesting at this point. Rathenau was a highly prominent German Jewish politician, and from 1922, indeed, he was the German foreign minister, and he was assassinated by members of the far right in 1922, in the same year. Rathenau, like Meisel Hess, supported the complete assimilation and full integration of the German Jews into mainstream German society and culture. And he too wrote in very negative terms about what he saw as physical characteristics of the Jewish race, not challenging but accepting and using stereotypical descriptions. This is an excerpt from his famous, or rather infamous, article Höre Israel, in which he says, "As soon as you have recognized your unathletic build, your narrow shoulders, your clumsy feet, your sloppy roundish shape as signs of physical decline, you will resolve to dedicate a few generations to the renewal of your outer appearance." This is clearly, you know, addressed to his fellow Jewish Germans. Comparing the two, however, also highlights the differences of their stances. Whereas Rathenau sees a need for the Jewish race to consciously educate itself and assimilate in terms of the demands set by the Germans, he argues for the conscious self-education and adaptation of the Jews, I quote, "to the expectation of the Gentiles." Meisel Hess's understanding of the assimilation process is that of cultural integration, and it is linked to an eradication of negative genetic material in the German people as a whole. Meisel Hess does not describe the conflict as one between the German and the Jewish race, but one between positive and negative physical attributes. Relying on the scientific eugenic concept of the striving for objective biological improvement, she avoids any discussion of race and champions the evolution of the human species as the task of the entire population. Still, in Die Intellektuellen, the negative physical attributes are carried by her Jewish characters. And we may see at the root of this the phenomenon of Jewish self-hatred, which I alluded to earlier, or Jewish anti-Semitism, the rejection of the Eastern Jews by a highly educated and assimilated Berlin German Jewish writer. Sander Gilman has written extensively about this and interprets it as a negative projection, a position not uncommon among the highly assimilated Jewish middle classes. But what is unusual and interesting here is the way Meisel Hess presents this rejection of the markers of Eastern Jewishness. She bases it on the premises of scientific objectivity and on the promise or the potential of the eugenic program for the human race per se. I quote, "more beautiful people, That is the demand that needs to be fulfilled to heal the world. And this brings us back to the question of Olga's childlessness. In Die Intellektuellen, Meisel has described stereotypically Jewish characteristics as flaws or defects, and the otherwise idealized literary figures, marked by them, hold back from reproducing in the service of the evolution of humanity. This applies to Olga just as much as to her brother Stanislaus, for Olga too has her brother's crooked and protruding nose and the same thin straight line of the mouth. But now we find a rather stunning loop in Meisel Hess's argumentation. If her Jewish protagonists are barred from contributing to society's evolution by procreation, that does not mean in her book that they cannot still be leaders in the evolutionary process. How? The answer is again provided by the concept of the step family. Stanislaus is described as a member of the young generation of highly assimilated cosmopolitan free Jews, an eminent representative of the intellectual struggle. His heart still harbors the old ardor from the Sinai, but his reason boldly climbs the summits of Western culture, up to Darwin, Nietzsche, and Kant. Stanislaus is conceived as the personification of pure intellect, and in the combination of Jewish ardor and Western reason, we recognize Meisel Hess's ideal of assimilation as a merging of two cultures. Stanislaus marries Lore, the single mother who has proven her strength of instinct by having secured her child the best possible genetic disposition. The combination of intellectuality and instinct is thus achieved in this marriage, and Lore's child, therefore, the next generation, can climb the next stage in the evolution of mankind towards wholeness. Jewish intellectuality is here thought as a mindset, a capacity. It is not determined by or even related to ideas of Jewish tradition. Rather, it is embedded in a concept of cultural cosmopolitanism. And this is absolutely crucial for the understanding of Meisel Hess's program. Throughout the novel, she embeds her ideas very pointedly and explicitly in a West European philosophical and scientific tradition. The citation of Darwin, Nietzsche, and Kant in this last quotation is just one of an abundance of references to thinkers and writers, ranging from Aristotle and Virgil via Hegel and Heinze to Ibsen and Walt Whitman. But first and foremost, the references are to Goethe. The book is shot through with direct and indirect quotations from his work. And this embedding is strategically important in several ways. Firstly, it is the author's attempt to move her work and program out of the very limited circle of reception of women's literature by placing it within the male-dominated tradition of Western culture. Secondly, very pragmatically, the emphasis on this tradition and specifically on Goethe aligns Meisel Hess with the editorial program of her publisher Eugen Diederichs. He became a very, very famous and very important figure in publishing at that time. He became the editor of a journal called Die Tat, and Der Tatkreis is seen by many historians as the circle that prepared Hitler's rise. Eugen Diederichs devoted his publication program to promoting the humanist tradition in conjunction with eugenics. In a prospectus for a new book series entitled The Politische Bibliothek, he cites two of his main concerns as the work against leaving the planning of social and cultural life to chance and the promotion of the ideal of the whole human being in Goethe's sense. Thirdly, Meisel Hess tones down her earlier, more extreme Nietzschean positions, emphasizing her concern for the whole of society rather than the rights of the individual. In this way, she is positioning her work so as to be acceptable for a bourgeois reading public, a strategy that she very clearly continued to pursue in the years to come. 6 years after Die Intellektuellen in 1917, she published a book entitled Die Bedeutung der Monogamie, The Importance of Monogamy, in which, as the title indicates, she presents a very different opinion on the bourgeois ethic code and emphatically accepts it. What we see very clearly then is an attempt to position her work in the mainstream of German culture. And closely connected with this is her emphasis on the scientific character of her ideas, which is indeed noted and commented upon in many of the contemporary reviews. The discourse of science, just like that of the humanist tradition, can be seen as a way out of marginalization. Both allow Maisel Hess to position herself right at the center of society and its concerns for the future. And with the combination of her rather contradictory ideological convictions, the propagation of women's independence, revolutionary sexual politics, the concern for the improvement of genetic stock, and the intellectual ideal of the culturally cosmopolitan German Jew, she shows both women and Jews as integrally and indeed centrally involved in the development of the new generation of German society. Eugenic science is thus turned into a program that is set against anti-feminism and against anti-Semitism. This is eccentric, but it is also rather impressive. And it illustrates the difficult position of the female Jewish intellectual who could not rely on any established and generally recognized position in society, but had to work with all her wits towards establishing this position. So, to sum up, I've just given you a glimpse today of two very different examples of how the axes of discourse of Jewishness and femininity could be handled in the construction of identities and positions within society. In Else Kroner, we have a campaigner for a traditional concept of femininity, a writer who used the identity debate among Jewish women to promote her campaign, but who otherwise distanced herself as far as possible from any Jewish identity. And Grete Maisel Hess, by contrast, who developed a strategy that placed both women and Jews at the heart of the plans for a future society. These are two very different worldviews and rhetorical undertakings, and they are two very different women. And yet, despite all their contrasting convictions and arguments, they both highlight the precariousness and intricacies, the mental and rhetorical somersaults involved in this process of self-positioning undertaken by German Jewish women in the early 20th century. These are tales of the unexpected, and this is what makes for their fascination.
Adela, thank you very much. I understand you're happy to take some questions.
Absolutely.
You ended by making the point that you made at the beginning, that your two, the particular two women that you were going to talk about in the seminar, Kroner and Maisel Hess, represented those sort of two axes of positioning of Jewishness. I just wonder, can you say something about the canon of women Jewish writers as a whole? You know, do people polarize against one or other axis? And are Jewish women writers outside of Germany positioning themselves in that same kind of way? Just
To be honest, what you just mentioned is one of the premises that I started out on, thinking that, you know, there's possibly, you know, those two axes, but there isn't. That is what I'm finding. Basically, these are the two extremes, I would say, and there's a whole spectrum of positionings in between. And also, what became clearer and clearer to me while doing this is that there is no way we can talk about an identity of these women. They position themselves, you know, very, very actively, and it is really a rhetorical undertaking, this, you know, to make sure that to position themselves between these axes. And what also, considering your question, what we have to take into account is that it isn't only the Jewishness, it is the axis of femininity goes completely, it's almost like a sort of, you know, Möbius strip or something, that it's so interconnected. And it always, you know, crosses each other. It forces, you know, the attempt to combine these two axes forces them into the most outlandish ways of arguing their case. which just brings home the pressure they were under. And I think that is different. You know, in the early 20th century, in that time, they were under this enormous pressure because, you know, because this was really one of the main points of discussion of society. They had to try and maneuver themselves out of marginalization in these two respects, which I don't think is the case so much in other cultures. You know, even in the German culture at any other given point, that was really, you know, a point where it came to its head.
So there is a social political context which is informing and affecting.
Yeah.
So in a comparative sense, then you wouldn't necessarily expect to find that same kind of polarization if you were looking at Italian German.
No.
Italian women.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't. No.
Well, if I can chip
Yes,
exactly. And it's also a country that also sort of descends into a totalitarian regime shortly after this. And from what you say, I recognise that the majority of Italian Jewish writers would have taken more of a Krona type position.
Right.
So of heightened assimilation, sort of trying to almost hide away and erase any trace of, you know, Jewishness, and indeed embracing Christianity eventually. And this is epitomized in the figure of Margherita Sarfatti, who was the official biographer of the Duce, his lover, but also very much of a sort of Jewish woman who was intent on denying and erasing traces of her Jewishness. So, so that's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that cases like Meisel has existed as well, but I think the Krona is more of a model when I think of Italian Jewish.
I mean, what I haven't mentioned here is that there are more straightforward cases as well, like Elsa Lascasciulla, who was really, you know, one of the more better known Jewish writers of the period, who very, very straightforwardly aligned herself with Jewishness, and indeed even with the Eastern Jewishness, you know, claiming that there's you know, this potential of the you know, the almost mythical power of the Eastern Jewish identity. So that was also possible at the same time, and that is what I find quite stunning. You know, it was all open to them. You know, it was just a way of finding their way within this. I mean, I even started out naively thinking, you know, of German Jewish women writers as somehow, you know, a body of women that does the same thing, which, you know, is completely blown out of the water now.
Yeah, one of the things I was thinking about, I will take the Jewishness out of your talk. I know that I shouldn't, but I meant to, because what I got out of it was womanhood and differences in womanhood, and writing about being a woman. So even though you were looking especially at being a Jewish woman, I'm kind of taking that out because I'm thinking of the Spanish side of things, which is there were so many modern women at the beginning of the early 20th century, but then the thing that happened in Spain is they completely disappeared. There was a moment, of course, the Civil War came and they all had to either flee or shut up.
Yes.
And I was wondering whether something like that happened in Germany, or because of the war, or whether this kind of modernity went through the 80s and continued until nowadays.
Well, it was of course entirely reversed through Hitler's regime, and you know, if you sort of just take, put a spotlight on very superficially on what happened was that, you know, under Hitler's regime, the you know, the woman as mother was emphasized.
Yeah.
Then after the war, you know, everything went into the rebuilding effort. So the woman was, in effect, you know, women were very strong because they were the ones who were rebuilding society. But the view of them was, it's in a very paradoxical way, you know, they didn't gain the status of independent and workers, but very much, if you look at the 50s, it's not very different to here, you know, the 50s ideal is that of the housewife. So, you know, that's what strikes me so much, that that in 1911, I cannot hardly believe,
yeah.
you know, this is all being said in 1911. How far were they then, you know? And it even now sounds, you know, quite shocking to us, some of this. It seems to me, in some respects, we are working our way back to this point in society where everything was open.
Yeah. But that happened in Spain. It's amazing that they've been working on early 1920s, 1930s writers. And it's amazing how much forward they are
yeah.
than even
yeah.
us nowadays.
Yes. Yes.
Their way of thinking, their freedom, their yes. independence, their sexual freedom was much, much
yes.
Better than now.
yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
It does seem to be a very, very, very fertile potential sort of comparative, you know, Germany, Italy, Spain, different political, social
yeah.
contexts.
Mm.
Yes.
So what
yeah.
happened to the two women individually after they published these books?
Else Kroner died in 1938, I think, and I've only found a date of her death. I don't know where and how she died, but I mean, the only thing we know about her later years is that she, you know, she worked for Nazi ideology, so she, you know, she aligned herself entirely with that. Died in 1938. I don't know how. And then Meisel Hess. Unfortunately, she became rather ill, of mental illness, and she died very young. She died at the age of 40, I think.
She was
in 22, yeah.
Yeah, neither of them had long lives.
No, no.
1940,
yeah. 62. And, yeah. So, you know, we can only speculate on where they would have gone, but it is interesting to see that they were both changing very much, you know, and diverging very much from what they had previously said. I mean, as I say, Meisel Hess really became a staunch supporter of marriage, and the last novel that is unpublished only exists as a draft. And it is just a, you know, a family novel in which all the, you know, all the values of family are upheld. I cannot speculate why she does this. I mean, she was one thing I know about her from her. I've looked. There's an archive which has some of her letters she exchanged with her publishers, and it becomes clear that she's extremely, extremely. Clever in positioning and working out what will sell. So she is very, very interested in making herself heard and to adjust what she says to being heard. So that is maybe.
Yeah, when was that draft written? Because it will depend on what.
Later, 1915, 16.
Okay, so
yeah.
Not that late.
Not that late, no. But then, you know, as I say, she published this celebration of marriage in 1917, and then she died in 1922.
You mentioned at the beginning that the critics that have written about modern Jewish, your reading was very, very persuasive. Talk about the distance, and I'm wondering sort of where they were coming from.
Yeah, it's really stunning that you know, the thing is, I think it happens to all of us. You know, we see a trend, and then in both cases, they are looking at several books, and they are, you know, they're looking at who's written about the identity of the modern, of the German Jewish
yeah.
woman. And then, you know, they read it and they place it in there. And if you read it in isolation, then it is easy to miss it because it is very objective. But how they could claim that it was an account, you know, clearly by a Jewish, self-professed Jewish woman, that I don't understand. But I know how it happens, you know, as a researcher. You want things to fit, don't you, sometimes?
Is there an archive? Where's the unpublished novel?
It's in Marbach, this wonderful place in Marbach on the Neckar. It's a very small town. It's Schiller's birthplace. and there's a hill, and the whole hill, the, you know, the entire hill is sort of dug out, and it's a huge archive, and you can wander in there for, you know, for days and find all these wonderful things. So it's one of my favorite places, and they, of course, they don't have that much either, but I was very, very excited to see that they have works of these unknown women. You know, they are now really more or less unknown.
Sorry, but I'm not clear how they ended up at MoMA.
How they ended up there? I don't know. I really don't know. I can only guess that because she had this very, very prominent publisher, Eugen Diedrichs, that through, you know, that his papers may have been bought, and through that, because I'm sure there was no direct connection with the author. That's the only way I can think.
Any last question or comments to put to Gideon?
Did Eugen Diedrich serialise them?
No, it wasn't. It was published in its own right. But he published all her works, not only the novels, but also the sort of social criticism.
So presumably people have done a lot of work on where Nazi ideology came from. Are you implying that they might have been influenced by things like this?
Hang on,
in the 1930s, I mean, were these books remembered then, or had they gone out of print and forgotten?
I don't think it was that influential. I think it's the other way around. It's a movement that is much stronger than this sort of lone voice of Else Kronas. It's the other way around. This was a movement that grew, and she fitted in with it. I don't think that she, blazed a trail in thinking in any way. It is really a case of being pragmatic in both cases, you know, of pragmatically placing your work where it will be heard.
Mm. I see.
Mm.
Well, Medina, as we all struggle to understand the human condition, it always strikes me that the social scientists looking for their simple, single, univariate explanations are going in the wrong kind of direction, because everywhere, when you start to look, there's heterogeneity and there's complexity. And I think you've demonstrated that very well, despite the fact that you chose your two polarizing axes.
Mm.
It's clear that between and across there are lots of nuances. We look forward very much to seeing this published in the not too distant future. So get to work on it. And thank you again for
thank you very much.
Giving us this seminar and stimulating all the questions.
Good.